Hello, it's Shahid, and welcome back to another Creative Floor Awards podcast. Surprise, surprise. Our award show is open, and third deadline is Friday, the 5th of April. Regular listeners will know that I did a shout out on LinkedIn a while ago, calling out for people to share their best and craziest and inspiring agency tales. And I had a recording scheduled with Mark Denton. For those of you who are fairly new to the advertising creative space, Mark is an absolute living legend and one of my all-time heroes. He's been in the industry for well over 40 years and has basically done it all. He's been an art director, creative director, agency owner, award-winning director, photographer, Royal Academy artist. He's definitely one of the coolest creative people you'll ever get to meet. And I'll put his details in the show notes just so anyone who isn't aware of him can check out his incredible work. He also did an agency internship last year just to get an idea of how agency world changed since his arrival into it. And I think it kind of shows that curiosity for the most creative people never really ends. Anyway, I'd set up a call to get Mark's agency tale. And as you get with someone like Mark, I didn't really get an agency tale. I got something completely different. And I loved the conversation so much, just kept the recording going. And I just thought I'd share the chat with you as I heard it. It's completely unedited. I think you'll get something out of this. It's very honest, very open, very inspiring when you get towards the end, once we get all the all the negative stuff out of the way. It was a very long conversation, so we've cut it up into some digestible episodes. So make sure that you do hit the subscribe button wherever you listen to your podcast to make sure that you don't miss them as soon as they drop. Just lastly, a massive, massive thank you for all the lovely messages you're sending me about this season's podcasts. I'm glad you're enjoying them and at least making some of you laugh, bringing you a bit of sunshine in the week. Anyway, here's an absolute cracking, cracking one. Enjoy.
I'm glad you want to talk to me about stuff. At the same time, I haven't got a bloody clue what stories I can tell you that will be relevant in any way nowadays.
I just had this idea over Christmas, and I just thought, since COVID, like, no one's got any stories, and they're all really boring. You know, they're all like, I had a really bad internet connection once. You know, it's just really sad. And I just started thinking there must be, well, I know that I've heard some incredible stories, and unfortunately, I think they're all going to die out, and with the people that have them in their head.
Well, you know, I suppose that's why I've done the internships relatively recently. I've done a couple of internships, one at St. Luke's and one at Grey, and I volunteered to be an intern because I really haven't got a clue how advertising works now. And what was fascinating for me was going over to the likes of Grey, especially because that was the most recent one, and got the young people took me down the pub, and they're every bit as creative as we used to be. So it's not like the talent is not there anymore, and it's not like the personalities are not there anymore. I think the system just doesn't allow people to be that expressed inside work hours, and that's why this magical thing has suddenly appeared, which there's a whole DNAD category for, the side hustle.
Yes.
So it's almost like, come to work and be sensible, go home and do the more creative stuff.
Yeah, that's weird, isn't it, when you put it like that? Yeah,
it's bloody weird. You know, we used to call them hobbies in the old days, but suddenly they've got this highfalutin name, side hustle. And again, because I'm bloody nosy, is it all right for me to just be waffling on like this, by the way?
Yeah, this is great.
Yeah, because I am nosy, and I am genuinely interested in advertising still, and why it is like it is now. And I know a lot of advertising money is spent online now, as opposed to in more traditional mediums like posters, for instance. I'm on the underground because I've got a freedom pass. So I make good use of that. And I'm on the underground all the time. The posters are still there. I drive down the road, the 48 sheet posters are still there.
Yeah.
Same with the bus stops. Still got posters stuck to them. Turn on the telly, adverts are still there, but they're just not as entertaining as they used to be.
Yeah. So what do you remember, Mark, like in terms of stories that kind of made a difference to you, you know, the funny ones, the crazy ones?
Well, that's the thing that I thought I'm going to struggle to say anything that's relevant now, because, you know, if I think about the way things used to work, I think about when I was at Leo Burnett and I started there in the 70s. In fact, that was my second agency. I started in 75, I think. By 79, when I went to Leo Burnett, and my boss used to disappear down the pub about 5 to 11 when the pubs opened at 11 o'clock. And I used to go down there and meet him afterwards when it was lunchtime. That used to be a mildly amusing eye-opening story insofar as, yeah, sometimes in the afternoon we'd go to the pictures and we wouldn't go back to work till about 4, because we'd walk, you know, from St. Martin's Lane across to Leicester Square and see with the latest film. And now you say something like that and a youngster would look at you and say, well, so what? I don't go in Mondays, Wednesdays and Fridays. So what used to be a bit of, oh, you used to just go to the pictures when you wanted to or go down the pub at 11 o'clock. People take the whole day off now. And that's the normal way of working. So what was a slightly alternative way of working, a bit different from working in a bank, is suddenly commonplace. Oh, I stay home and stroke the dog. Really? Oh. So some of your wildest advertising stories. Ah, yeah, we go out for a long lunch. And guess what? We'd go out to lunch, posh restaurant, and before you knew it, it was kind of tea time. So we'd just stay and have the evening meal as well. And you say, well, yeah, well, I've got a Deliveroo, and I stayed at home the whole day and I watched the telly. Wow. It's kind of a lot more, you know, in many ways, even though from a creative point of view, it feels a bit more restrictive, from a living point of view, i.e. just wandering around in the world, there's never been as much freedom.
Yeah.
Because people don't go into work. And in fact, you know, when I used to, after all this bloody time, how long have I been doing it? I'm not very good at maths, but I think it's about 47 years. Yeah, 47 years I've been doing it. I'm still interested in advertising or commercial art of any kind. I genuinely used to go in on Christmas Day. I happened to team up with a partner, Chris Palmer. He was my writer for a long time, 11 years. And he was the same as me. You know, he didn't really keep in touch with his family. So he wasn't doing anything Christmas Day. I tossed a coin and thought, so go back and have Christmas lunch and just see, you know, old people shouting at each other, or do I go into work and have fun with my mate with a blank sheet of paper and piss ball about coming up with ideas? So I opted for that, you know, most years that I work with Chris. And now, you know, it's almost like, I remember telling that story, not a very exciting story maybe, but we used to go in on Christmas Day. Actually, one Christmas, we're in Covent Garden in our offices when I have my own agency. Me and Chris working away Christmas Day. And ring on the doorbell. I thought, who's ringing the bell Christmas Day? Tony Kay, director. He walked past, saw our light on. He was out. I think he was editing something on Christmas Day. And again, another nutter who loved working. He came up and had a chat and a meeting on Christmas Day. But I've told that story on Twitter, I think, back when it was called Twitter. And I wouldn't say it was a pile-on, but I kind of got, suddenly I found myself under attack. Like, it was a toxic thing to say because of the, you know, the hard-won freedom of not going into work, to actually be making a virtue out of going in on Christmas Day suddenly made me in the wrong somehow, like I was doing something evil or sinful.
Wow.
And that just felt bonkers, you know, because it was my little, you know, it was never showing off because I was never a martyr. I just was doing something I liked doing.
But that's it, isn't it? Because people don't like their job. So when it comes to holidays, they want to run away from it. And what you're saying is it, work was the best bit of your of the week and the day.
I remember, I've forgotten how long I was at my own agency before I got kicked out of it. I suppose that's a bit of a story, getting kicked out of my own agency. Well, it's not, you know, it's not much of a story, you know. Insofar as it happened a lot of times before, and you never think it's going to happen to you. And, I'm thinking, where do I start this story? Effectively, this is where it started. I was a visualizer over it. I'll go right back. You can obviously edit this any way you want to. But I'm a Leo Burnett and I'm a visualizer. But I wanted to be an art director. And I was given the only spare seat in the creative department because everyone had their own offices at this time. I mean, that was a bit different back then because a creative department wasn't the open plan call center that it looks like today. It looks like it could be an insurance company. And for me, I cannot get my head around the modern way of working insofar as you work in a communications industry and yet a creative department, the way it's set up now, is all about non-communication. Unless you're on a Zoom call in a meeting with about 20 other people, then it's rows and rows of creatives or otherwise, head stuck to a computer, headphones on, everything about it says, don't talk to me. The opposite of communication. So creative departments on that level are not very exciting places because there used to be banter and games of cricket and fire, literally. They were much more exciting. Exciting creative ideas being exchanged in a very vigorous fashion. And talking to, just having a chat with the funniest, brightest, most creative people I've ever come across. And I'm not saying they're not there now, but you can't get to talk to, you know, when I did my internships, you know, just walking onto a creative department and looking for an opportunity to talk to someone. I don't know whether it's because it's like I was like the old git turning up to the disco when I was a clubber back in the 70s, big clubber. Anyone over 30 walked into the disco, you think, what are they doing here? And maybe they were looking at me like that. I don't know. But getting a chat was hard. But given that, they did take me down the pub over at Grey and I enjoyed chatting to them then. I'm waffling now. I can't for the life of me remember what I was talking about. Anyway, okay, I'm a visualizer over at VA, Leo Burnett, that's what it's called. Leo Burnett, visualizer, and no one knows what a visualizer is anymore, effectively, because there was no such thing as the internet, and you couldn't print an image off of a computer because there weren't any computers. If an art director came up with an idea and they wanted a finished visual, they would come to me and I would be the person drawing the layout of the ad. lettering all the type. Again, you know, it was big money just to get the headline set then. So you wouldn't get any typeset, not for an initial rough. I'd be drawing up the type, drawing the picture, colouring it in. That was my job. But I wanted to be an art director. So when my boss, the bloke who had the only seat left on the creative department, so I had to sit in his room. His name was Norman Ike, the inventor of the milk tray man. So he goes down the pub at 5 to 11. I stay in the office until 1 o'clock, lunchtime. I could have gone down the pub with him. I chose to stay in the office because I answered, you know, while he was down the pub, I answered the phone. And if it was a rep for a photographer's agent, you know, photographer's agents or illustrations agent, rep, whatever you want to call them, if they wanted to come in and show a portfolio, I used to pretend that I was an art director and I'd make an arrangement with them for them to come in and show me the portfolio. So they'd come in, show me the portfolio. It might be a photographer's rep, and it might be a producer trying to flog a reel. I'd look at it, and they didn't know I was the visualizer. I'd just sagely nod and stroke my chin, and say, "Look, I haven't got anything at the moment, but I've got these concepts that I can't get through. Do you want to do a test, or do you want to do a pilot or anything?" So that's where I got the hang of talking people into doing free. Finished photographs, illustrations, and shoot commercials for me. Because I had hoodwinked them into thinking I was making them think I was an art director, which I wasn't.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's not the story I was telling you, but actually, it's a bit of a story insofar as by the time I finished doing that, and I kept doing it, you know, I met Chris over at BBH, Chris Palmer. And I'll tell you that story in a minute. I met him and he was intrigued by it. So I continued doing it. In fact, I might tell you that story later. But first of all, I'll tell you how I got a job at BBH. Because I was a visualizer, I had to draw other people's storyboards as well. So I did this half a dozen different, they give me the script, I break it down into a storyboard, I draw it up. That's how I learned how to structure film, drawing storyboards. And anyway, I'd do these half a dozen storyboards for my boss, Norman, and Bob Stanners, for Cadbury's Cream Eggs. And they're going into research. What they don't know is, because I've read all their scripts, it's very easy to work out the strategy. It was all about being irresistible. Cadbury's Cream Eggs, they're irresistible. Can't resist them, Cadbury's Cream Eggs. I think that was the line. And so I do some of my own scripts and I draw them up into storyboards and I sneak them into the pile of storyboards that are meant to go into research. And the account group come along, they have a look at it. They like some of my scripts and they end up going into research. Of course, at that point, I'm not saying that Norman and Bob were miffed at that point. They weren't, really. They weren't threatened until one of my scripts came out better in research than all of theirs. Then they started getting a bit humpy. And that was really the first commercial, the first big commercial that I'd ever had a hand in, you know, a solo hand in. And I ended up in either Shepperton or Pinewood. Is a bloody big set, because what I'd done is that I'd done this little scene, 15th or 16th century street scene, whenever it is, not very good at history, so this old historical scene, London streets, a sedan chair pulls up at the traffic lights. Of course, there wasn't traffic lights back then, so the traffic lights are made up of red, green and amber candles mounted on a kind of ancient traffic light looking carriage lamp affair. Anyway, sedan chair pulls up at the red lights. They patiently wait. Then another sedan chair pulls up alongside, and this has got a radio playing inside, like loud music, and he's got a visor that's got Chaz and Nell written on it, and he's got furry dice, and he's got turbo stripes down the side. They start eyeing each other up. The lights change. The first sedan chair takes off. The turbo one is just sitting there, and the bloke inside very casually just presses a button that says "Ye Turbo" on a kind of engraved brass plate. Anyway, out the top of the sedan chair comes these two rods, and then suspended on the end of the rods with string are cabbage cream eggs, and they fall in front of the bearers like a donkey and carrot scenario, only they're cream eggs that fall in front of the bearers. Then the turbo powered sedan chair takes off, whizzes along, overtakes the first one, cut to a close up, bloke inside eating the cream egg, having a good time. So that was the script that did really well in research. I ended up making it. I'm in Pinewood on Shepperton, bloody great big street scene, built massive set. It was a beautiful, massive set, beautifully lit, because there wasn't CG back then. No clever way of doing it apart from making it. So I'm standing there looking at the playback, as my bosses were there, of course, as well, because they had to be, because I'd never really made a commercial before, because I was the visualizer. In wanders this bloke that I knew of, but I didn't know, Chris Palmer. He was shooting on the next set. He'd got a job in advertising after being a dispatch rider. He'd only been doing advertising for 6 months. He got a job at BBH. There was only 30 people at BBH then. It was a small, really hot agency. Everyone wanted work there. And he comes in and said, "What's this all about then?" I start chatting to him. I don't know him. He's looking at my storyboard. He's loving it. He's looking at the set. He's loving it because it looks bloody impressive. Before you know it, I've got a job at BBH because Chris said, "Look, I need an art director." He'd been working with John Egerty for his first 6 months after being a dispatch rider, and Barbara Noakes is Egerty's writer at the time. She comes back from maternity leave. Chris needs an art director. He phones me up. I go over to BBH, but of course, I've completely blagged it. I've blagged my way in there. I've got these test things that I've done with various photographers and illustrators and stuff that weren't real ads. I talked them into doing some stuff for me. So I had mock-ups of real ads. I had loads of magic marker drawings, because that's what I did. Loads of storyboards and this commercial. So even though I got the job, I felt I was a bit of a fraud. So I did what I did at the time when any major thing came up. I went to see my clairvoyant. So I booked up to see Madame Claire of Catford, Brown Hill Road, Catford.
Wow.
Because I was scared. Yeah. And I thought, oh, John Egerty, king of art directors, I'm going to get found out. Hottest, new agency in town. I'm really a visualizer. I make the phone call to book up Claire. I've been going since I was about 17 because my mum was really into clairvoyance and stuff. So I'd gone there after she recommended it. And I was going along with a copywriter friend of mine who's over at the Obernet. Her name was Jennifer Kelly at the time. And she was a bit worried about her matrimonial status because she was 30, didn't have a boyfriend. So she was single and wanted to know what was happening next. So we would get, it was essential that we both went along to find out what Claire had in store for us. Anyway, Chris, first week I'm working with him, I didn't know the bloke. He said to me, "That sounds interesting." He heard me making the phone call. "That sounds interesting." I said, "Yeah, it's good." Well, what happens is you go down to Catford, go and see Claire, Brown Hill Road. She tells your fortune. Go and have a curry afterwards. Talk about the predictions. He said, "Oh, can I come?" I said, yeah, sure. So we all go along there. I go in first because it was my idea. And, you know, it was a great night out anyway. It was for, just for the spectacle. I'm still not 100% sure I believe in any of that nonsense. But at the same time, there's also some very spooky things happened insofar as you go in there. This is a good night. Her brother opens the door and her brother looks like Lurch out the Addams Family, only for real. He's got this dyed black hair plastered to his head. He leads you to a little tiny corridor where you sit there, you know, so what he calls the waiting room, but it's a corridor that is so narrow, your knees touch the wall in front of you. So it's all, but he squeezes past every now and then while you're waiting and goes in another door at the end of the corridor, only to emerge in a different door, out of a different door, you know. So yeah. Even that's a spectacle. It's very odd. Anyway, I get led in first, says Claire. Darkened room, black tablecloth, dusty chalk marks all around the table, battered old playing cards, not tarot cards, playing cards, single lamp on the table. Anyway, I go in there. I have to, she looks at me palm first, and she gives me the cards. I have to shuffle them. I give them and cut them. She puts half on the table, she takes the other half, puts them round the round table on these dusty chalk marks. You can't see what they are. You know, they've whatever was there was worn out, but she can, you know, she knows what they are, obviously. Then she turns up the cards one by one. And she said, right, okay, you've just met someone. You've met someone really significant, very important person you've just met, very important in your life. I see you both having your name over the door. Oh, yeah. She said, I see you in front of the camera. I see you behind the camera. I see your name over the door. And I see fame. I see fortune. Hollywood. In front of the camera. Behind the camera. Name over the door. It was a name over the door phrase that was the biggest one. Or the most used phrase, I should say. And I come out, I think, oh, that's good. It felt very positive. I said, what do you mean, name over the door? She said, well, you're going to go into business together. Right, well, that's exciting. I mean, just met the bloke. We're going to have the curry afterwards. And I say, yeah, name over the door in front of the camera. And Chris said, she said the same to me. And Jennifer was really pissed off insofar as she said, she just kept saying to me, you've got a wedding ring hanging over your head. That's the only thing she kept saying. It was all variations of that. Wedding ring hanging over Ed. And anyway, 3 weeks later, she was married. She didn't have a boyfriend at the time. A week after the prediction, she went to a party. She met this American lawyer. She'd never met him before. 2 weeks after that, they got married.
Wow.
So when I got a phone call years later, me and Chris did pretty well. You know, and because I was a visualizer for a long while, I was probably about 28 by the time I started at 20. I was 27 or 28. Actually, maybe I was 27. Because I think I was a BBH for a couple of years. I was 27 and Chris was a year older than me, 28. We felt like we were late starters, if you like. I've been doing, you know, I've been in advertising for since I was 20. So we both pedaled really hard and we did bloody well, won lots of awards and stuff, really started getting on people's agenda. So like when this bloke I'd never heard of, Paul Simons, he wanted to start a new agency. He was the ex-managing director of GGT. He phoned us up. We were on the list. You know, I think we just won both gold awards at Campaign Poster Awards. So we kind of cleaned up at Campaign Poster Awards for Heineken. So we were on his list. He phones us up, said, look, my name's Paul Simons. You don't know me. I'm the ex-managing director of GGT, thinking of starting up an agency. Do you want to have a chat? And I just cut the receiver and said, Chris, it's that phone call we've been waiting for. So what Claire didn't say was that actually 6.5 years after you start the agency, because you know, we had the chat and we started the agency, Simons, Palmer, Denton, Clemmer and Johnson. 6.5 years later, you're going to get kicked out of your own agency. She never said that. But do you know what? I still probably would have signed anyway. Because it did, you know, it opened a lot of doors. Had a great time. You know, ad for ad, I think we were the biggest award winners in Europe for certainly the last couple of years before I got booted out. I think the official reason I was booted out was neglect of duty. And yet, in that 6.5 years, I'd only taken 10 days off and I'd gone in most Christmas days on top of that. So I could tell you more about that, but apparently I have to have a lawyer present. So I won't go on about that anymore.
What was the first year like?
Bloody great. Here we are. I was still only, you know, I think I was 30 when we first started talking to them. You know, and I think at the time you think, oh, 30. When you're 20, you think 30, that's old. I look back at 30 now and I think, God, they look like 30-year-olds look like they've just come out of school. And I really, I've got to be honest, I didn't know what I was doing. I'd only been an art director. I've been an art director for less than a decade, that's for sure. I've been an art director for 5 minutes. So how long? So if I wasn't a proper art director until I met Chris. So, yeah. Yeah, 5 or 6 years I've been an art director. So I really didn't know what I was doing and didn't, you know, running a department. I'd never got past being a middleweight art director, even at Lowe's. You know, I wasn't a group, what we used to call, they call them creative directors now, but we used to call them group heads. I was never a group head. I never had anyone else working for me. So, and like I say, Chris had only been in the business 6 months when I teamed up with him. So he'd only been a copywriter for 6.5 years.
What do you wish you knew before you started that whole journey? Thank you so much for listening. Do hit subscribe wherever you listen to your podcast so you don't miss the next episode as soon as it drops. If you have a spare 10 seconds, well, even if you don't have a spare 10 seconds, please do write us a review. Good one, obviously. Until next time.